Pull up a chair. This one starts with a math problem. July 23, 1983. A brand new Boeing 767, one of the first glass cockpit airliners Air Canada ever put into service, is sitting on the ramp in Montreal, shiny, sophisticated, and her fuel gauges are dark. There's a snag in the fuel quantity processor, so the ground crew is going to do it the old way, the way we've always done it. They're going to dip the tanks with a stick and do the arithmetic by hand. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about the day an airliner ran out of gas at cruise altitude, and the two men who flew a fuel-starved jet down to a dead stick landing that nobody thought was survivable. Now here's where it gets interesting, and I promise you, it's the least glamorous villain in aviation history. It's a units problem. Canada was switching to the metric system. This 767 was one of the first airplanes on the fleet that measured fuel in kilograms instead of pounds. The crew needed to load enough for the leg from Montreal to Edmonton, with a stop in Ottawa. They dipped the tanks, got a volume in liters, and now they needed to turn liters into kilograms. To do that, you multiply by a number called specific gravity. The right number, the kilogram number, was about 0.8, but the figure that got used, the one everybody reached for out of habit, was 1.77. That's the pounds per liter figure. So they did the conversion, and the answer told them they had way more fuel on board than they actually did. They loaded roughly half of what they needed. Everybody signed off, and the jet taxied out to fly across half a continent on a tank that was going to come up empty. Before I take you up to altitude with this crew, let me tell you who's paying the bills today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's The man in the left seat is Captain Bob Pearson, seasoned airline pilot, and this matters, an experienced glider pilot, a sailplane man. Somebody who understood in his hands and his backside what it means to fly an airplane with no engine and make the energy last. Keep that in your pocket, you're going to need it later. In the right seat, First Officer Maurice Quintal, sharp fella who happened to know a thing or two about a piece of ground we're going to talk about in a minute. They're cruising along at 41,000 feet, somewhere over Ontario. Smooth air, routine flight, and then a chime. A warning tone for the fuel pressure on the left side. The crew figures it's a fuel pump acting up. A pump going bad is a nuisance, not an emergency. Fuel still flows without it, so they start thinking about diverting to Winnipeg just to be safe. Then the second chime, the right side now. And then the thing no airline pilot in 1983 had ever trained for, because the checklist for it did not meaningfully exist. The left engine winds down, quiet. A minute or so later, the right one follows it into silence. Picture that flight deck. You're 7.5 miles up. Both engines have quit. And this brand new glass cockpit, all those beautiful electronic displays, most of them go dark, because the engines were the thing generating the electricity. The cockpit that was supposed to be the future just went black and quiet. Now the smart engineering saved their instruments. The 767 has a little emergency turbine, a ram air turbine, a RAT, that drops down into the slipstream and spins up just enough hydraulics and electrics to fly the airplane. So Pearson's got basic flight instruments and his controls. What he does not have is thrust, or a checklist, or, and this is the part that gets me, an airspeed for the glide. Nobody had ever published a best glide speed for a Boeing 767 because why on earth would you? Two big engines, you don't glide a jetliner, except today you do. So Bob Pearson, sailplane pilot, does what a glider guy does. He feels for it. He settles the nose on a speed that keeps her flying and stretches the distance, and he starts trading altitude for miles, the same way you would in a sailplane over a ridge, except the sailplane weighs 132 tons and has 161 souls in the back. Meanwhile, Quintal is running the numbers on where they can put her down. Winnipeg's too far. They are sinking faster than the math likes. And that's when the first officer remembers something from his own life. He used to be in the Royal Canadian Air Force, and he'd been stationed at a place called Gimli, an old military field north of Winnipeg. He knew it was there, off to the side, within reach. What Quintal did not know, what nobody in that cockpit knew, was what Gimli had become. That old runway had been turned into a motorsport park, a drag strip, and that particular Saturday, it was packed. Race cars, campers, families, kids on the pavement. There was a race meet going on, right on the very strip of concrete Bob Pearson was about to aim a silent airliner at. Now here's where it gets interesting. They line up for Gimli, and a glider will tell you the one thing worse than being too low is being too high, because you can't add power to fix high, and you can't just wish the energy away. Pearson comes over the threshold, and he is high, and he is fast, too much energy. On a runway that's shorter than he'd like with people on it, Pearson reaches for a tool, not an airline tool, a tail dragger tool, a little airplane tool. The forward slip, you cross the controls, full rudder, one way, opposite aileron to hold your line, and you skid the airplane sideways through the air, so the fuselage itself becomes a great big speed brake. Every student who's flown a Cub or a Champ into a short grass strip knows the slip. You bleed off altitude fast without picking up speed. It is a beautiful old-fashioned seat of the pants maneuver. Bob Pearson slipped a Boeing 767, a 130-ton jetliner, hanging sideways in the air on the edge of the runway, dumping altitude like a piper on final to a farm field. There are people who saw it from the ground who say they'll never forget the sight of that big airplane cocked over sideways. Dead quiet, sliding down toward them, he straightens her out at the last moment, and now the final problem. With the engines gone, so were the normal systems that blow the landing gear down and lock it. They'd tried a gravity drop, letting the wheels fall and lock under their own weight. The mains came down and locked. The nose gear fell partway and did not lock. She touches down mains first, hard, right at the very end of the strip. And the instant the weight comes on, Pearson stands on the brakes hard enough to blow two tires. The unlocked nose gear folds right back up under the airplane, and the nose drops onto the concrete and starts grinding along in a shower of sparks. And believe it or not, that saved them. That nose grinding on the pavement was extra braking, scrubbing off speed on a runway that was way too short, headed straight for the crowd. The airplane slid to a stop. There was a small fire up front in the nose area, and the folks who were there, the racers, ran to it with their own handheld fire extinguishers off their race cars and put it out. Not one person seriously hurt, not on the airplane, not on the ground. A few minor injuries getting out the back because the tail was sitting high with the nose down and the escape slides came up short. That was the whole of it. They call her the Gimli Glider to this day. Now the part I love, the part that's pure hangar flying. There was an inquiry, of course. They always dig into the chain, and it was a chain. The metric changeover, the broken fuel gauge, the specific gravity, the habits, the paperwork. Plenty of blame passed around, and Pearson and Quintal took some heat in the immediate aftermath, which, if you ask me, is a crime. Because look at what actually happened up there. A captain who flew gliders on the weekend brought a powerless jetliner down out of the flight levels with no thrust, no published glide speed, and a runway full of people, and he set it down with a slip he probably first learned in something with a tailwheel and a stick. And a first officer who reached back into his own Air Force past and pulled out a runway that wasn't on anybody's plan. That's not luck. That's a lifetime of flying showing up in about 17 minutes. And here's the thing I want the student pilots to hear. The maneuver that saved the day, the forward slip, that's not exotic. Your instructor will teach it to you in your first dozen hours, stick and rudder crossed up, airplane sideways, altitude bleeding off. The captain of that jet reached for the same skill you're going to practice next Saturday over a 2,000-foot grass strip. Never let anybody tell you the basics don't matter. On the worst day of Bob Pearson's professional life, the basics are exactly what he had left. Both those men eventually flew again, and Bob Pearson, the sailplane pilot who glided an airliner, he stayed a glider man to the end. Of course he did. The details on this one come from the Canadian government's own Board of Inquiry, the Aviation Safety Board report, and from the accounts Pearson and Quintal gave over the years. If you want to go deeper, there's a good bit of writing out there on it, and you'll find a few of our notes over at radiohangar.com. Next time you're practicing slips and somebody in the pattern gives you a hard time about it, you tell them about the day a slip saved 161 people at Gimli. This is Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down, and I'll see you next time.